Very welcome to today's Generate podcast. We're in English today because we have a very special guest today.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is going to be a very special part, which I have been looking forward to very much. And I can introduce him, right? This is Professor Sarosh Irani, who we are interviewing today. He is one of these people you don't really need to introduce in the field, but still I'm going to do it. He's head of the neuroimmunology lab at Mayo Clinic now in Florida. Many people still associate him a lot to Oxford, where he has spent a lot of his career and still is associated with. Please correct me in a second if I'm saying wrong things. But except for where he is, I think he's best known for what he has done. And this has really made a huge impression in the field, you know, and discovered, obviously, parallel to other people, LGR1, Caspar-2 has really done a huge clinical part in autoimmune encephalitis. But what I love about his work is that he combines clinical expertise with basic molecular immunology. And this is very unique and super special. I'm extremely happy to have you, Sarosh. Thanks for sharing some information. Thanks for taking the time. And yeah, happy to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for the kind introduction.
Do you want to start, Isa, or do you want me to start? No, you can go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Since Frank already mentioned you're in the field of autoimmune encephalitis, both clinically and scientifically, I would be interested, what was fascinating you at the start and what still does today?
I think the answer is patients for both. And I think we're really lucky as clinicians in the field of autoimmune neurology. I remember when I went into the field, it was because I couldn't decide, do I like cognition more, movement disorders more, seizures more, peripheral nerve more? I couldn't decide. And then I met a patient who had all of them. And I thought, this is exciting, not only because she had all of them, but because she got better. And so then I thought, okay, well, I can indulge myself with all the neurological subspecialties I like so much. But in addition to that, I can actually make patients better. How satisfying could that be in life? So, and I'm really happy to say that's where I ended up. Actually, that patient I remember very, very well. I was in England, we would call it a senior house officer. In the US, it would be a very, very junior resident. And I remember her so well because she got better. And at the time, she had an antibody, which we didn't know much about. It was a antibody against the voltage-gated potassium channel, or thought to be. And so after having met her, I wrote to the person that discovered those antibodies, Angela Vincent, who was only an hour away from me in Oxford. I was working in London. And we met up, and then we agreed that a PhD would be a good idea. And then really the rest is just a natural progression of what happened. So it was a very cool, one patient made the difference. And still today, patients make the difference.
That is super interesting. And the interesting thing about talking to other people also on this podcast is a lot of people tell you that this serendipity of this first patient, your index patient, like the one who got you on this trip, right? This is what a lot of people remember and what has brought a lot of clinicians into this field. So I completely agree. This is a great story. And this probably turned out later on to be LGR1, right? One of your first LGR1 patients, or?
She did, yes.
Okay, cool. Interesting. So, but you did your PhD with Angela then and, became also this basic immunologist. So how do you do it? How do you combine clinicians and molecular stuff? What helps you? Where's the chance? Do we need that? Or is it a hobby and just for the super specialists? Or are we really learning a lot from this?
Oh, it's definitely a hobby. I mean, I often say to people, I'm really lucky that I get paid to do my hobby. Much to my wife's disgust. But, you know, I think the reality is, I think while it is a lot of fun, you're right, it is hard, and it is hard to combine the two. It's perhaps the most exciting thing, though, about my current job, and I think about many aspiring young neurologists. I think, you know, strongly encourage you to think about doing it. It's not straightforward. You know, you have to keep on top of, I would say, three sets of literature, which I don't, right? I don't manage it anymore. But I remember when the field started, I knew every single paper about LGI1 after Josep published in 2007 about NMDA. I could say firmly by 2015, I still knew every NMDA paper. you know, now it's impossible. The field moves on so quickly. Immunology has moved on so quickly. I get shown things by people now and I'm taken aback. I didn't see that paper. Where did that come from? So it is really difficult to stay on top of the literature, to try and be at the cutting edge of the research. I don't underestimate that, but it's been a lot of fun. I think the key, I think, was having a PhD and a postdoc time, which were dedicated to research, allowed me just to focus on that. And whilst, you know, I would still go and see patients once a week or during my PhD, more like once a month, it would be the concentrated time to be able to focus on that, immerse in that, understand what goes wrong when you do immunohistochemistry, understand what can go wrong when you do a PCR, understand how you get them occasionally working. And I think that dedicated time really gave me a strong grounding to now be able to miss 50% of the papers in the literature, but still hopefully get the gestalt of what's going on.
Yeah, true. But it is completely rewarding. I agree. And I think it does make you a better clinician, right? If you are aware of the molecular stuff and also how complicated these diseases are once you really get down to the basis. I mean, one of the dangers, I think, of not being connected to labs and not being involved in the research is this danger of reductionism, right? You make things too simple and then you have a delta between life and your ideas of reductionism. And this is something I completely agree and I think is very valuable about being a clinician scientist. Some kind of, you know, continuously try to falsify yourself, number one. And number two is having a continuous reminder of how complicated reality really is. And our clinical concepts are often very reductionistic. This is what I personally see as an additional advantage of doing both, in addition to rewarding your own curiosity. I completely agree. So let's go back to clinics a bit, right? So from a clinical point of view, which of these diseases has, let's say, caught your fascination the most? Probably all of them, but just pick, you know, the one pick or the one that has been, you know, on your mind all the time during the last couple of years. And tell me about your priority.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it has to be LGI1 because, you know, I remember when we first saw the antibody down the microscope and we thought, we debated it for ages. Is it a false positive? Is it real? It took several months to clarify that in our heads. But so for me, it has to be those patients. And I've definitely seen more of those patients than I have any others. And I still find the whole setup amazing. If you just go back to first principles, who would have ever thought an man in his 70s who presents with something that many clinicians would years ago have just called dementia actually turns out to have an antibody-mediated disease and you can get very close to cure in that patient? Who would have thought that they have a, you know, 90% HLA association? I think that's amazing. Who would have thought that, as your group and we have shown now, that almost all the cells in their spinal fluid target one antigen? I mean, there are just so many amazing things about that disease for me that has really captured my attention. And I know you forced me to say one, but I'm going to say two, because the other one that I think is fascinating is IBLON5. And I think I've done very little primary research in that disease, but I think it's absolutely fascinating because otherwise we sit in a bit of an island, don't we? We are these guys who deal with these rare patients and we know what to do with a mGluR5 when it turns up twice in our career, but we don't know what to necessarily do with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So I think that insights that it might give us, and someone has to think of something clever to do with it. I don't think we can just keep saying it reflects on neurodegeneration. There has to be a focused way into that problem. But I do think that disease gives us the opportunity as a field to show that we can impact on much more than just these rare diseases, which aren't that rare, by the way. And they are important, very important. But, you know, that would be the other disease that I would pick. And the overall, and I've started to do this in some papers and reviews recently, I call these not to miss diseases. Because let's be really honest, right? In neurology, if you have a patient with a number of different disorders and you miss them for a few months or you misclassify them or maybe you completely misdiagnose them, there's very little harm done in most cases. But here, we know that every day matters in some of these diseases. And that's an incredible statistic as well, right? That's the other thing that always captures me. It's true in NMO, it's true in LGI1. Every day matters in terms of immunotherapy administration. So I think there is something very special about being an expert in these diseases, which allows you to hopefully teach others and impact on the lives of many patients that would have otherwise had, you know, difficult courses and maybe never been appropriately treated.
Very true, very true. Can you, maybe not all our listeners are super experienced in these diseases, can you also, from your very long-standing knowledge of this disease, then take LGI1 and give us a quick explainer of the clinical disease and maybe the immunological background? Like, let's say LGI1 encephalitis in 3 minutes. Okay, how would you explain it to a neurologist who hasn't been in the field for ages?
Okay, fascinating and unique is what I'd say. I think, you know, these are usually people in their 60s and 70s who present over a few weeks with seizures. And for me, it's called encephalitis, right? People don't think this is a seizure disorder. This is a seizure disorder. And this is a unique seizure disorder through the whole of medicine. More seizures per day than I think any other disorder that I know of, at least. So that's the hallmark. It's frequent, very focal, very short-lived often. Often EEG negative, don't get put off by that, seizures. We described a very specific type of seizure, which we called fasciobrachial dystonic seizures, which when you see, and I've seen clinicians' faces when they see these patients, they go, oh, that's it, because it's so distinctive. You can't really miss it, right? And when it happens, these patients then progress to develop a cognitive syndrome, typically a dense amnesia, behavioral difficulties, personality changes. But don't be put off then when you do their lumbar puncture or when you look at their scan. They may well be normal, right? So routine testing, not that helpful at this point. But if you look in more detail, their CSF is packed full of B cells and plasma cells. They are LGI1 reactive, almost all of them are. And so something very amazing is happening in that patient's CSF. But the question is, how much does the CSF and the brain contribute to the disease versus the periphery? And as you know, Frank, our data suggests that the disease is generated in the periphery, the mutations arise, the antibody specificities arise there, and then they get access to the brain. And we're yet to work out mechanisms for that and what's going on there. But I think the other thing to say is that these guys, I've got 1 minute left maybe, they have a very strong HLA predisposition. So something is going on which polarizes their T cells as well. And I think that axis of unusual demographic, very distinctive phenotype, weird immunology involving T cells, B cells, and clear HLA molecules gives us a real opportunity to dissect this disease properly. And how many diseases can you say that for in the whole of medicine? So if you go through the whole of medicine, how many diseases have been dissected to the point where you can say, okay, the disease starts here, it progresses here, it goes to this compartment, it does this in this compartment? Very few, right? But of course, the ultimate question would be, what causes this disease in a 75-year-old man who is otherwise well for the rest of his life? That's the ultimate question. And so that's what I hope understanding what we do so far will give us access to at some point, maybe one day.
There's at least a few goals remaining. That's good. I mean, it's good. We don't know everything, all right? We're not on the other side for quite some time. Go ahead.
The important other thing to say in my remaining 20 seconds is these patients get better with treatment. You can give them steroids, plasma exchange. You can give them B cell depletion. They get better with time. And some of them get better dramatically. You know, within a few days of treating them, some of them, their seizures will decrease dramatically or go away. So it's a very rewarding disease to understand and treat, but I think it gives us a cool opportunity biologically.
Okay, so then just one additional question to that directly. So what is your standard treatment approach? I know we don't have super lot of data. A lot of what you're going to say is not evidence-driven, but empirical. But what do you do? You have this 70-year-old LGI1 patient who you diagnosed, he's had symptoms for 5 months. Some cognitive dysfunction in those seizures. So what do you do?
Honestly, if I was in a general hospital, I would call an expert because it gets a little bit complicated at different times. So now my practice is to treat very rarely with anti-seizure medications because we've seen lots of side effects on that. Patients have issues with driving when they have to come off them, and they are very ineffective on the whole. So usually my practice would be to treat them with steroids as their predominant anti-epileptic. I would plasma exchange most of them. I would then wait and watch a little while. I would definitely be giving them more steroids at this time, because we've certainly seen many patients who relapse quickly when their steroids are withdrawn quickly. And I would be aiming to give them steroids for a minimum of 6 months. The question is whether we can give them a steroid sparing agent. I think there's no clear data on this yet. There's some data suggesting that rituximab is not very effective in these patients. There's some data emerging suggesting that rituximab may have an effect. Others in the world have used mycophenolate with some, I gather, unpublished, but success. And so I think there is an opportunity to keep 70-year-old men away from steroids, basically, long term. But I always tell my patients something when I first see them. In 2 years, you're going to be off all treatment. It might be a little bit of a rocky course in between, but in 2 years, you're going to be off all treatment. So have that like goal for your patients in mind. That some of them think they're going to be stuck on immunotherapy for life. They're not. It's a monophasic disease when treated efficiently at the start. So I always give them that hope.
Oh, fantastic.
Sorry, I like to weigh in here because of a question. If I get that right, it's not that easy to evaluate the success of therapy. Did I get that right? And why is that?
So I think it has been difficult to work out whether longer-term treatments help these patients. I think there's two reasons. One is that when you give them acute treatments, their seizures go away quite quickly, certainly within 2 months, typically, maybe sometimes even within 2 days, we've seen. So you have less to measure. The second thing is a lot of our outcome measures that do allow us to measure longer term effects are pretty crude. And the field has used a score brought in from stroke, which really doesn't give it sufficient granularity in this disease. So I think there's a few reasons why it's been hard to measure and hard to evaluate. We and others have produced patient-reported outcome measures, which I hope will give us a little more nuance to be able to answer some of those questions in the future. I also think just numbers probably matters, and combining data from multiple centers might start to give us some of these answers too.
This is a super important point, and we need more data. That's what you hear a lot from people, right? Every people give talks, they say we need more clinical data, treatment data. I know you've been involved a lot in clinical trials, and there's been advisory boards and in other situations. So what is your thought on how should the field proceed in this field in terms of trials or evidence? I'm not saying standard RCT, I'm saying evidence. So how can we solve this bottleneck of evidence? We are running into these rare diseases with difficult to recruit trials, with small numbers, with very, like in other fields, artificial inclusion criteria. So if you could wish, right, make the world come true, or your wish come true, how would you generate evidence in these diseases?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think you've already highlighted several of the big problems in the field. So I think it depends what angle you come from. I'm a bit of a devil's advocate on this question, as you know, which is why you've probably provoked me. You've poked the bear now. So I think the key point that I make when I think about this is money, I'm sorry to say. A drug company will usually spend between 100 and 250 million from pipeline development through to the phase two trial, phase three study, maybe. I think that 250 delivers only benefits for the drug company, almost exclusively. So I think it delivers them a FDA or, you know, an EMA approvable drug, usually, because they set the trial up to do so, right? Yes, they consult experts, but in the end, it has to be their call. They're funding it, right? That's appropriate. Has to be their call how the trial is set up. And investigator-led studies are few and far between, and I hugely respect people who can do that because it's a huge amount of effort and work. But these trials, and we've seen this in different fields now, end up giving a small number of patients this label or this indication, and it helps with some insurances, for sure. So it doesn't... I'm not going to be completely polarized on this, but it helps with insurance and it helps give clinicians some certainty that they can say to their patient, look, if I give you this drug in 1 year, your average outcome will be this, this, or this. But as you correctly say, inclusion criteria are completely arbitrary, right? And almost never reflect real world. The way the study is set up rarely reflects real world. You know, there's a certain number of drugs they can have before, there's a certain number of drugs they can have for afterwards, and there's certain durations, and they don't follow them up for as long as you'd like. And all these things mean that in the end, we end up with data that are great in that scenario, but not really extrapolatable. And that's the real world entity. The real world entity is, okay, I'm going to use this drug now. How does it affect my patient here today? So my approach would be a comparative effectiveness approach, which would be much cheaper. We'd all be able to pool our data that we've collected over the years, and we would just make do with that. And no one would say this is level evidence X, Y, or Z, because we just agree we make do with that in the field, rather than spend $250 million getting a drug company's one drug approved. Instead, we spend $250 million on doing things that are more useful for the patients, like developing outcome measures. I think that's practical and useful. Like understanding why, as you and we have, Frank, the CSF is often normal in these patients. Well, it's clearly not normal when you look properly, but just standard tests tell you they're normal. That would help detect patients earlier. We spend the money trying to get expedited antibody testing of high quality. That would really change the patient outcomes and really help direct clinicians carefully. And of course, we spend the money trying to figure out what causes these diseases so we can stop them in the future. So if we spent the money on that, I think we'd get much more bang for our buck than the industry trials.
Yeah, I poked the bear and I couldn't agree more. I completely agree. This was expertly worded again, and thank you for that very clear statement. But let's go back one step and say, all right, you get all this and we need basic science, we need diagnostic studies, we need real-world data. However, how do we get the regulatory agencies to accept other than RCT evidence? And what would be the minimal level of evidence we need to still have a basic measure of, well, of course, safety, this is mandatory, but also like a minimal standard of, let me not say efficacy, but like surrogate markers of efficacy, that there's at least some evidence for that it really will work. And you can, well, comment on that. I know there's difficult answers, but would love to have a quick impression of your ideas on that.
Yeah, I think you're right. We can't ignore that because that is to the patient's benefit. But I think if we had guideline statements showing, as you and I know already, there will be trials that have failed already just because of recruitment and because of practical issues, logistical issues around the trials. I think we could perhaps have a guideline statement where we say, look, we've tried. This is what's happened. This is the experience of the field. Now, there will also be trials that deliver, right? We know there's at least one study that's going to deliver in the next few months to years. So we will have a little data. We will have that. And I think we have comparative effectiveness. We have groups of clinicians who see lots of these patients who can pull their data and we can do some retrospective studies. And we write guidelines saying, look, as a field, we see limited benefit in randomized trials, apart from the fact that this is like your epidemiologist's gold standard for where we should go. And everyone's become dependent on this, and everyone's forgotten that randomized trials are not the panacea in some fields. Instead, we should focus on this approach. These are our data. This is how we're going to treat our patients based on it. And we're not going to go back to hundreds of randomized control trials unless the companies, you know, can show us a real benefit for patients going forwards.
I do want to ask about your also vision of the therapies of the future. So basically, where is the biggest clinical need? Which of these diseases can we not treat sufficiently? And do you have ideas on which kind of treatment you would put money on? I mean, also very, very philosophical question, maybe about strategy in the future, but
yeah.
Just want to share some insights.
I mean, I have to say, I think so far I've been completely wrong. So I never thought that antigen-specific antibodies, which could block the receptor, could potentially work, because I've always, you know, we're always trained in the core of medicine is treat the cause, right? Get to the cause, figure out the cause, treat the cause, you cure the disease, you prevent the disease in future. But of course, here, what people have done is this beautiful setup where an antibody which doesn't mediate a pathogenic effect binds the receptors and blocks the other antibody's binding appears to be modestly effective in a macaque model. So it's pretty exciting stuff to think that that could work, because then that gives us a very cool avenue into all these diseases. Now, let's go with the scenario that I try and convince my lab is the likely scenario, which is that I'm always right. And that scenario means that this company have got it all wrong. And we're back to square one at the end of that. And we have to treat the immune response. So treating that BNT cell response is the other way to think about this, right? That is more cause driven. That is more root cause deletion. And so with that in mind, I think there will also be some opportunities to delete those B cells very early on. And hopefully that will be an effective therapy for these patients. But I think overall, in terms of treatments, this field has a very cool opportunity to think about precision treatments that other fields can't do. You know, if you work in rheumatoid or you work in lupus or you work in cancer actually is an exception sometimes, but mostly there's hundreds of things leading to these diseases and causes. Whereas you get the feeling in these diseases, there might be more of a linear answer. So I'm pretty excited by that, but I wait to see where all these different ideas go, because at the moment we're in a very cool time in the field where people are trying several of these things at the same time. So I'm excited to see where we go in the next few years.
What do you think where we're going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, you're really quizzing you on the future here. Treating a little bit like an oracle. Just showed our high respect for your knowledge in the field.
Yeah.
I'll try and be oracle-like. I mean, I'm guessing as much as anyone is, right? But I think precision therapies will start to emerge, and we will get an idea whether they work or not. And we will get an idea at what level of the immune response they work, i.e. at the level of the soluble antibody, at the level of the B cell, at the level of the T cell, at the level of something else. So, I mean, I don't think we're that far from these. Research groups are developing them. Companies are interested now. I think there will be momentum if one of the trials kicks off and is successful. So that's what I'm really hoping for. And that perhaps is the biggest benefit of a trial, is that if you get a positive result, I think the funding from drug companies goes up substantially.
I think the really interesting part would be integrating all these things you said into like a uniform platform approach to patients, right? I mean, you alluded to this with the precision medicine. I mean, my, you know, impression of what could be possible in 10 years' time would be like the patient coming in, having this deep phenotypization of what's really going on molecularly in the CSF, maybe on the lymph nodes. A lot of work you've done, which we haven't found time to talk about, shows great results of the lymph nodes. Also maybe in triggering tissue like tumors, and then being able to identify the pathogenic clones, B cells, T cells, maybe atypical cells, whatever, and then track them, deplete them, delete them, maybe repeat after a couple of years when you have relapses. So yeah, this is, I think, a chance we can develop in the field where we need to integrate all these little pieces of the puzzle. But I really share your vision here and your strategy, and I completely agree. Isa, we are nearing our 30-minute time limit, or probably are already above it, right? So close to it. So you want to wrap up maybe, and then we just invite Sarash again another time and hope he finds time in his probably pretty busy schedule, right?
Brilliant idea, yes. I have a loving final question that I really, really love to share, and that is to give advice to young people in the field. You know, if young neurologists are interested in neuroimmunology, or would like to become more active in AA care, what would your advice be?
So my advice would reflect a little bit of my experience, but principally my most favorite ever clinician's experience. So I was very fortunate. The first time I stepped on the wards as a first year doctor, I think it was 3 months into my time, I got to meet this very reticent, slightly eccentric character who I'm not going to name, but ended up winning a Nobel Prize. He was an amazing clinician, and he used to give us fantastic advice kind of almost under his breath on a ward round. And we used to listen and we didn't quite know who he was at this time. This was 2003 and he won the Nobel Prize several years later. And the advice he used to give was be clinically guided, but start to think of questions which will last your lifetime. And I really like this advice. So he says, first start off writing small case studies and case reports about your patients. Think about them carefully. Think what the mechanisms could be. Understand the biology as best you can and try and generate ideas based on your patients. Once you've done that, think about how you would answer them from a molecular or clinical level, whatever your the level of your question is. And then take that idea and expand it out to something which is bigger, soluble in your lifetime, but keeps you going for the whole of your lifetime. So I think that's really, really good advice. And I would say to young clinicians, you are super sought after. Don't underestimate how much clinician scientists, or as I've learned to call them in America, physician scientists, bring to the party. Don't get me wrong. I think basic scientists do huge amounts of important work, but there's nothing like seeing a patient on a Monday, thinking of your question, oh, why did they develop that? And we have examples of this. You know, I remember when I saw the first set of patients with LGI1 antibodies, we'd just been sure about their validation in the lab. This was 2009 or so. And I went to see them and some of them had these nasty rashes appearing. And the rashes were generated by the anti-seizure medications. And that led us to go and type them for their HLAs because the only thing known at the time was that HLAs predispose you to these rashes. So suddenly you've gone from a very basic clinical observation. This guy's got a nasty rash, which took him to ITU. You don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to see that. But you start to then pick apart what's the molecular pathway, what's the mechanism, does this influence my patient? Suddenly a big finding, okay, this could lead to a bunch of things. So I think I took his advice and I've used it in my career. And we maybe on the next podcast, we'll go through several different examples of this because they ring true in my head whenever I go to clinic. And so I think it's very much be grounded in the patients, but think, what can this teach us always? And I think that's a really exciting position to be in. We're really lucky to be able to do that.
So wonderful. Thank you so much. I mean, this has been a really interesting, intriguing, and I think insightful 30 minutes. We have many topics we have left over, which we touched upon, right? Eglon-5 molecular studies, monoclonal antibodies we haven't even talked about, and the chances of using those in the research, which you've also helped to pioneer. So we definitely have to ask you again to come on time. In Germany, we say little finger, whole hand, right? When you give somebody the little finger, as you've done by visiting us on the podcast, we ask you for a repeat. All right. Thank you so much, Sarosh. And this was brilliant. Okay.
Great. Thank you both. Really enjoyed it.
With pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Das war schön.
Ja, fand ich auch. Ja, wirklich ein netter Kerl, mit dem man auch gut reden kann. Und wir haben uns ein bisschen natürlich wegtragen lassen vom Gespräch, aber das hat nochmal gezeigt. Mit ihm kann man ja über alle Aspekte in diesem Feld reden, von Grundlagen, Klinik, Therapie, Studien. Fand ich toll.
Sympathischer Mensch und die Verbindung aus Offenheit und Gradlinigkeit in der Kommunikation hat mich heute sehr begeistert, muss ich ganz ehrlich sein.
Mich auch, muss ich auch sagen. Und die Geschichte der LG1 in 3 Minuten, Klinik und Wissenschaft, fand ich auch toll. Das ist natürlich prädestiniert, um das einmal zu subsumieren. Aber das hört man auch nicht jeden Tag so knapp und fokussiert und insightful im Englischen. Ja, also voller interessanter klinischer und wissenschaftlicher Einsichten. Also das kann man sich, glaube ich, auch nochmal langsam nachträglich anhören. Hat mir Spaß gemacht. Gerne wieder und wir laden ihn wieder ein, oder?
Ich würde mich darüber freuen.
Ja, ich mich auch. Super, dann von meiner Seite ganz herzlichen Dank an unsere Zuhörer. Wir hoffen, Sie fanden es genauso spannend wie wir und bis zum nächsten Mal, wenn Sie wieder den General Podcast einschalten. Vielen Dank.